And welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. It's great to be here, and I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone. I'm a naturopathic physician and herbalist with the American Herbalist Guild, professional herbalist, and also one of the founders of the University of Bridgeport College of Naturopathic Medicine. So it's the only accredited program on the East Coast. And I'm really excited to be here. I'm going to be my own guest today, so I'll be kind of like Gollum talking to myself, if you follow Lord of the Rings. No. But I'll be talking about a very interesting topic that's near and dear to my heart, and that is particularly nutritional balancing, mineral analysis, and toxic metal evaluation using your hair. So that's going to be the focus of today's program. We're going to be talking about the scientific validity of using hair analysis and try to figure out why it's often scoffed by mainstream practitioners, and not even mainstream practitioners. There's many of my own colleagues at my own college that really haven't followed the literature on using hair analysis as a good tool to help your patients achieve optimum wellness. Remember, you could always get more information about our busy schedule of walks and talks and seminars and webinars and trips to Jamaica by visiting the websites, which is naturalnurse.com. Dr. Kamai is the keeper of our calendar, naturalnurse.com. And also, you can contact me at Dr. Z Naturally, drznaturally.com. So onwards with the program here, and we'll take a couple breaks here and there. I want to talk about hair analysis. So what's really interesting about hair analysis, you know, a little backdrop. You go to the doctor, and, you know, usually you expect them to do like a blood analysis on you, check your white blood cells, maybe what's called a wellness profile or health panel, which really is none of that at all. Doesn't really look for wellness. Just evaluates if you're currently sick or not. But we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about the hair. But rarely does the doctor say, well, I'm going to be sending some of your hair to the laboratory for analysis. You know, because for some reason they're not trained in this in medical school. You have to go to become an ultimate specialist in order to know about hair analysis. And by that I mean usually a pathologist. Remember back, for those that are old enough, the show Quincy, one of my favorite shows, watching pathologist. But if you're of the more young generation, you remember a Dr. Lee from Connecticut, who was a fantastic pathologist that would often find various things at a crime scene, maybe a shred of hair or things like that. And from that, they were then able to solve the crime. So we see that hair element analysis is an important tool for determining specific nutrient minerals and trace minerals that your body may be lacking, but it also can reveal what toxic elements and pollutants are in your body. That's another thing, like when you go to your general wellness checkup with your allopathic doctor, they usually don't ask, well, how much lead is in your body, or how much cadmium, mercury, aluminum, or arsenic have you been exposed to? They make no references to these toxic metals at all, and neither do they think that they somehow impact your health in general. It's just totally not looked at in mainstream medicine. But doctors who are privy to understanding these types of technologies and lab reports can basically allow the patient to have a whole other dimension of understanding the underlying cause of the disease, or what we call in Latin tole causum, the underlying cause of disease. So performed and interpreted correctly, the hair analysis is in fact an extremely sophisticated method to assess the body's body chemistry, your metabolic type, levels of some toxic metals. Some toxic metals may not be accurately looked at by the hair. And also provides information about trace minerals, nutrition, and even your endocrine system, how well that's working. It also can tell you your inflammation tendencies, blood sugar tolerance. And recently, there's been a whole discussion about what's called abnormal methylation. I'll go into more detail on that later on in the program. But you can even tell, in a way, at least as a screening tool, if you're making enough of life-saving antioxidants such as glutathione and others, and do you have enough B12, folic acid, SAMe in the body? That's a type of sulfur-containing amino acid. That's S-adenomethionine. These are all important for epigenetic expressions and protecting your DNA against damage and preventing cancer and degenerative diseases. That's why when you read about SAMe, it seems like such a panacea. You know, so many things seem to respond to SAMe, from depression to arthritis, rheumatism, because it's doing fundamental things at the level of your cells with these very important methylation pathways. And we had a doctor on a while ago, Dr. Goles, who was an expert in curcuma, talking about how curcuma seems to help with the methylation pathways as well, protecting DNA, and that's why curcuma seems to also be such a great panacea to do many, many things. But back to the hair. Remember, proper mineral balance is essential to preventing as well as overcoming our health problems, and many of our quote-unquote disease states really have to do with mineral imbalances and nutritional deficiencies. Also, heavy metals. I had a patient here just last week that basically every day she ate a tuna fish. And in Connecticut, they call it a grinder. You know, it depends where you go in the country. Some place it's a sub, some place it's a hero. Well, they call it a grinder in Connecticut. So anyway, got to get used to the lingo because I'm originally from New York. But, you know, that's going to give you a pretty heavy-duty bunch of mercury in your body. And then that gets changed to methylmercury, and that can become a problem. Well, that can be accurately determined by doing a hair analysis. Although there are some caveats that we'll talk about. There are some people that are so low in some of the other minerals that the hair analysis looks at, things like selenium, cobalt, molybdenum, sulfur, and minerals like that, that they may hold on to the mercury, and when you run the hair test, the mercury will look fairly normal, but or kind of high normal, but there's low levels of those other minerals, and that would indicate that that person is holding on to the mercury and not detoxifying. That would mean that they have a sluggish liver, because all those minerals I mentioned are very important for the liver to detoxify the metals. And if people don't have the resources, they're going to hold the metals in the body. But that can be by the savvy practitioner who's trained to read these hair analysis, that can be looked at. So in other words, you just can't look at a hair analysis as a linear lab test. You know, just because that person doesn't have high mercury at that reading of the hair doesn't mean that mercury is not deep in the body. So that's why you need to be trained in this. And it's an important test, though. And, of course, heavy metals antagonize the absorption of minerals. And so that's probably why we're seeing that. But hair permanently records the past events of your environmental and dietary history, and it reflects really more what's going on in the bodies and the cells than does the blood or urine. You know, due to homeostasis mechanisms, our mineral and blood levels are kind of constrained to normal levels despite inherent or dramatic deficiencies. I'll give you good examples of that. You might say to the doctor, well, why don't you just check all the minerals in the blood? You know, why don't you just do a blood calcium or blood magnesium? And here's the problem with blood tests. A lot of the minerals are very tightly controlled in the bloodstream and serum. And that's to prevent, for instance, with calcium, that's to prevent fatal arrhythmias, which can happen if the blood calcium gets skewed one way or another. So what happens is that the body tightly controls that. So doing a blood calcium level, which is fairly relatively commonly done by many doctors. I mean, I think it's an important test. You know, clearly, if your blood calcium's out of whack, you got serious problems. But just because the blood calcium is normal doesn't mean there's enough calcium in the body. That's the point I'm trying to make. And doctors go on to erroneously interpret an abnormal blood calcium as that being meaning that the patient is, a normal blood calcium as that they have normal calcium throughout their body. And that is very, very wrong. A lot of people are slipping through the cracks. It's the same thing with magnesium and most of the trace elements, of which the blood is a very poor way to look at it. And it certainly is that fact with some of the heavy metals, such as lead. I look at what a public health disaster we're seeing today with lead toxicity in little children, where the public health commissioners are coming out with very erroneous ideas that if you screen young people for blood levels of lead, you're going to catch all the people that have lead toxicity. And that's just not true. While the blood lead levels is a good public health measure, and you do catch a lot of kids, blood lead only allows one to check the lead at the time it's in the blood. It does nothing to tell you of the long-term storage of lead in the body. And when you're exposed to lead, if your body doesn't detoxify it, what does it do? It stores it. It stores it in the hard tissues, like the teeth, the nails, the hair, the bones, and, of course, the brain and whatnot, too, as lead is a very dangerous substance. A blood test is not going to reveal once that lead is stored in those hard tissues. Only through hair and maybe some other types of analysis that more holistic and functional medicine doctors do, can you then determine that patient's lead levels. So that's why hair is so much, you know, needed in medicine today. Everyone listening out there should be getting their hair checked regularly to look for their nutritional levels. Now, serum levels are supposed to be, you know, the extracellular minerals, where the hair trace minerals are believed to be the intracellular things. That's why it's considered to be a better record of your body's mineral levels. The other thing that's interesting about the hair is it's not affected by dietary intake that day or week. So you could be, you could take a bunch of B12 in the morning. Say you have a doctor's visit today and you go for breakfast. Well, actually you're supposed to fast most likely before the blood test, so it's not a great excuse. But say they were testing your nutrient levels and they didn't tell you to fast and you decided to just take a bunch of minerals that morning for your multivitamin regime. Well, you know, by the time you get to the doctors and get the blood test, it's going to show, let's take B12 for an example, that your B12s are probably okay, assuming you're absorbing it and things like that. So what did that prove? That just proved basically that you took your vitamins in the morning and it's in your blood, but it doesn't really prove that that B12 is getting in your tissue and doing all the things that it's supposed to do. And so it just shows that you took it that morning and you absorbed it through your gut. But it doesn't show whether it's getting into the cells to do anything. And so the hair looks at how have you been behaving yourself by taking your supplements and things like that over the last 3 to 5 months, how long it takes for that hair to grow. It's also very, very convenient, simple, and cost-effective way to look at things. And so we're going to take a quick break and also contrast more about hair versus blood and that it's a screening tool, and we'll talk about the limitations of hair analysis. So we'll take a quick break now, and we'll return with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay with us.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss an herb we all know and love, cinnamon.
Ah, the spicy, sweet smell of cinnamon. Everyone recognizes the familiar aroma of this common kitchen spice. But did you know that cinnamon is an exotic plant bark with a long history of medicinal use in many countries throughout the world? Cinnamon was listed as an herb with medicinal properties in Chinese literature as early as 2700 BC. It is described in the Chinese medical text, the Tang Materia Medica, written in 659 AD. Cinnamon also enjoys traditional use in Ayurvedic medicine, the ancient healing art of India. It is mentioned in the Book of Moses and has been cultivated in Ceylon and Sri Lanka since 1200 AD, where much of the world's supply is still grown.
In Europe, cinnamon was regarded as a rare and precious spice. Many pharmaceutical substances, such as cough syrups and digestive tonics, contain cinnamon. It was also used as an incense and in perfumes. According to Chamberlain, writing in France in 1887, cinnamon possesses the greatest antiseptic properties. Cinnamon is gathered from the dried inner bark of the branches of a small tropical evergreen laurel tree. The bark is peeled off, and as the pieces are dried, they curl up into quills. These are the common cinnamon sticks that are used in herb teas and for baking.
In Chinese medicine, cinnamon is one of the most widely used warming herbs to aid in circulation and digestion. It is a common ingredient in small amounts in tea used for nausea during pregnancy. It is also used following delivery to decrease hemorrhage. Cinnamon raises vitality, warms and stimulates all the vital functions of the body, counteracts congestion, improves the digestive system, relieves abdominal spasms, and aids in peripheral circulation. The essential oils contained in cinnamon include eugenol, cinnamic aldehyde, methyl eugenol, tannins, and mannitol, which give cinnamon its sweet flavor. It also contains cinzenolin and cinzenolol, which are both known insecticides.
Try putting some liquid soap and cinnamon in a spray bottle and use on plants as an organic bug repellent. Cinnamon is also included in many medicinal recipes that are used for lice, scabies, and other skin parasites. Cinnamon has antifungal, antiviral, and bactericidal activities. It has been shown to suppress E. coli, Staphylococcus, and Candida albicans.
So, listeners, the next time you inhale that sweet, spicy aroma, remember, there's more to cinnamon than meets the nose as you reach into your natural medicine chest.
Well, great. And that brings us back to our program. And love that show about cinnamon. It's such a great spice over porridge and things like that, but so many other usage of the cinnamon. So we're talking about hair analysis. Now, we wanted to talk about, is hair superior to blood. And I don't really know if it's superior or not. The blood tests different things than the hair. But one thing about hair is it's certainly simple and non-invasive and very stable material. You can cut a hair and it will remain viable for years and years with little special handling, whereas, you know, blood tests go bad for very easy. And the scalp hair contains a temporal record of your element metabolism and exposure to toxic elements. And while hair mineral values often vary by a factor of 10 or more, making the measurement easier. In other words, a lot of the minerals get trapped in the hair and makes it easy for the lab to check for that. You don't need to fast for a hair analysis. And certainly, again, the other thing I like, and I mentioned this before, is that blood tests vary hour to hour. Even your hormones vary. If you run a cortisol, for instance, in the morning time, a blood cortisol, it'd be very different from the noon value and the afternoon value and the evening value. So hair is kind of stable. And, of course, advancements now in computer-controlled mass spectroscopy and other science have rendered hair analysis very cost-effective, accurate, and reliable when it's done right. And, in fact, the EPA, in a docket that they released in the 1970s, stated that if the hair samples are properly collected and cleaned and analyzed by the best analytical methodology using standards and blanks as required in a clean, reliable laboratory by experienced personnel, the data are reliable and remarkable. That was a quote from this 300-page document, August 1972, and they say, again, it's meaningful. The hair is a meaningful and representative tissue for biological monitoring for most of the toxic metals. We'll get into the fact that law enforcement uses hair analysis quite extensively, and, of course, toxicology, but not your average Joe and Jane MD out there. That's the problem, is that it needs to be incorporated more into the fabric of medicine. Now, the cons of hair analysis. There are some cons with every test. We went through the cons of the blood. It just is a snapshot of what's going on right now, or what you did very recently. In many cases, one exception would be like a glycosylated hemoglobin, where that would look at your long-term management of blood sugar over a couple months. But for the most part, blood tests are pretty much here and now. But the problems with hair is that hair analysis is very vulnerable to external elemental contamination by shampoos, bleaches, dyes, curing or straightening treatments. So now, you know, not being sexist, more women have these issues than men, although plenty of men dye their hair and their beard and whatever. So the first step when you interpret the hair analysis or even order one is to find out if the patient has had or done this type of external contamination to the hair. That kind of renders the hair analysis a little bit obsolete, and you would want to then discourage doing the hair test at that particular time and wait for the hair to regrow, getting fresh hair. Some people don't want to do that. If they're very gray and they're covering their gray, they don't want the gray to really show. So that puts a hamper on the hair analysis for the practitioner gleaning that information for the patient. You could use pubic hair. Pubic hair tends to be a very excellent source of hair, but it grows very differently than beard hair or head hair. It grows much slower and compresses the data into a smaller sample, so it's not as reliable for several things than the scalp hair. But a lot of patients ask me, well, you know, I could use pubic hair. And sometimes I'll do that if I'm monitoring a heavy metal case where I'm looking at the ebb and flow of the toxic metals in their body, because we all have them. We all have them in our bodies. That's the problem. Except, you know, how much is too much? That's the big debate in medicine. How much of these heavy metals is too much, and are they giving people symptomology that's unexplainable through other, you know, pathologies and other reasons? So that's why oftentimes people come see me. Now, the hair analysis also can look at the metabolic type. We'll talk about that in a bit. Looked at the mind, almost like the mind-body type, almost like the Ayurvedic doshas in a way, which is looking at the emotional and mental and physical symptoms. The hair can tell us a little bit about that as well. It can tell you how much energy you have, and it gives people you know, when someone's tired and comes in the office, it's kind of a doctor's nightmare because so many things that can be wrong. Hundreds and hundreds of things can be wrong with that patient. And sometimes doing the hair analysis and maybe a good organic acid analysis of the urine, you can plow, a good savvy practitioner can plow through hundreds of different reasons for the reason why for that patient is fatigued. And that's important, that's for sure. So also, it looks for tendencies for mental assessment. We run hair analysis on children with autism, adults and children with ADD and ADHD, anxiety, depression, mood swings, irritability, OCD, nervousness, schizophrenia, bipolar, and we often can find many metabolic imbalances using the hair, which once identified properly, we can really help that patient and bring into analysis. You can also look at the function at the cellular level of the thyroid, the adrenal glands, the ovaries, and even the pancreas. Assessing carbohydrate tolerance is a very interesting application of hair analysis. And I use it to quickly screen patients for hypoglycemia, metabolic syndrome, and other things. And I could usually see, you know, one thing about medicine is they often wait until the disease has already begun in order to diagnose it. There's not a lot of preventive medicine that happens in mainstream medicine. So, you know, you may notice possibly through a blood test that the blood is creeping up over the years, and good fasting blood sugar, say in the 70s or 80s, you know, is then creeping up into the 90s and above. And a lot of practitioners will just blow that off and say, well, when you become a diabetic, we'll treat you and, you know, we'll just put you on medication. Well, that's not what we do in holistic medicine. You know, it's the foolish man who waits to dig a well when he is dying of thirst, was it saying by the Neijing, the Yellow Emperor. And so hair analysis can give the practitioner advance warning and the patient advance warning if one suspects blood sugar metabolic imbalances, because many mineral imbalances are often at fault with those conditions, particularly if the patient's zinc is low, for instance. Well, if the zinc is low, then they probably can't make enough hydrochloric acid, and because zinc is important for the manufacture of hydrochloric acid, and then they're not digesting and absorbing their minerals, and then they're not getting enough chromium, and they're not getting enough vanadium, and that's going to impact the blood sugar. So many things can be gleaned from that particular thing. It also reduces guesswork in recommending diets, nutritional supplements. A lot of patients come in with a bag full of vitamins and minerals and say, Dr. Z, do I need these things? And I'm like, well, I could take a guess like anyone else, but maybe we can do some more objective testing to see if you really do need these particular things, you know? So, okay, well, it's half past the hour. We're going to take another quick break, and then we're going to talk about a little bit about how the hair is actually analyzed in the laboratory, how hair grows. And then we'll talk about we'll talk a little about forensic, how it's used in law enforcement, and then we'll talk a lot about some of the minerals and some of the toxic things and possibly how you can get your hair looked at by your doctor. Take care and stay with us.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll take a look at the soybean, its phytochemistry, and its role as a food and medicine.
It is exciting to see a resurgence in research by universities and food scientists on the role that foods play in disease prevention. Many of these institutions, such as the United Soybean Board, the American Soybean Farmers Association, and the National Cancer Institute, are busy developing designer foods, or superfoods, concentrating the essential nutrients and phytochemicals in soybeans and other foods that have potent medicinal effects. Commonly known foods which have soy in them include soy milk, a cheese-like substance called tofu, tempeh, a fermented soy protein, and tamari, a fermented soy sauce. The soybean is a rich source of many nutrients, including selenium, zinc, beta-carotene, vitamins A, C, and E, and 20 of the 22 amino acids. Soy also contains essential fatty acids.
Research on soy foods is vast and well known to health enthusiasts, although the general public and physicians in the United States may not be aware of this plethora of research. In Japan and China, however, this is not the case, as a voluminous number of scientific studies have been carried out in animals and humans. Chinese studies reveal that soy products can increase the ability, rate of activity, and number of white blood cells. Patients receiving chemotherapy and radiation can benefit from drinking soy milk, which in several studies demonstrated a protective effect on the liver and gastrointestinal system.
It is interesting to note that the British journal Lancet revealed that vegetarians and Asians who ingest high amounts of soy have the lowest rates of cancer. This is due to one of soy's constituents called genistein. This chemical is a phytoestrogen or plant estrogen, which can decrease and block the uptake of human estrogen and testosterone, as well as enhance its excretion. Like the drug tamoxifen, it competes with estrogen for uptake in the reproductive tissues. By doing so, hormone-dependent cancers like ovarian, breast, and prostate cancers may be prevented.
In conditions where there is a deficiency of hormones, such as osteoporosis and menopause, soy isoflavones, such as genistein, can weakly mimic estrogen and reduce the severity of these problems.
So, listeners, don't count out the versatile soybean. Make it a delicious and nutritious part of your natural medicine chest.
And welcome back to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z. I'm hosting the program today, and we're talking about hair analysis, the pros and cons. Should you get one? What does it tell you when the doctor checks your hair and adds that to the lexicon of various functional and nutritional testing that you can get when you're evaluated, whether yearly or annually or whatever? So welcome back. And so we wanted to talk about forensic medicine. You know, the police use hair as an ideal specimen for long detection of substances, whether that's poisons or drugs and things like that. And the analysis of hair specimens is very useful in drug and poison-related crimes and in their investigations. And so there's a great book called hair analysis in clinical and forensic toxicology, and that's used by law enforcement to look at hair and understand it, and it is admissible in court. The evidence, as long as there's like a good chain of command, it is admissible in court, and that is looks like Dr. Kintz, K-I-N-T-Z, is one of the authors of that. So when they look at the hair legally, they look at side-by-side comparison of the hair, chemical analysis. Then they do neutron-activated analysis and even DNA fingerprinting. But you need some of the follicle for that particular types of analysis there. So, you know, it's interesting. Besides the hair, you can also use nails. Nails have been shown to be very helpful in forensic toxicology as well. So whether it's the hair or nails, you can check for these types of things. Now, the debate is, does the mineral content of the hair reflect the mineral content of the body? And I think there's been a lot of research. It's not 100%. Every mineral is reflected equally in the hair, but many of them are, and that's why it seems to be a good resource that I think is overlooked by much of doctors. And particularly if you're exposed to a hazardous substances, a lot of factors determine whether that is going to cause harmful effects. For instance, like how you were exposed to that hazardous factor. What was the duration, route, or pathway that you were exposed? Did you eat the poison, drink it, breathe it, get it through your skin? Also, your individual characteristics like your age, sex, genetics, epigenetics, nutritional status, lifestyle, and the state of your health all determine whether that mercury or arsenic or lead or cadmium or whatever that toxin is going to end up causing ill health or not. But that's why the naturopathic physician or holistic doctor using hair analysis can help you. Now, how is hair analyzed? Well, it's a fact in physics that when you burn things, they release light. And the light that is released when you burn things and incinerate things can be picked up by the spectrophotometer, and like the rainbow, like the kind of the colors of the rainbow, the sophisticated computer machinery can then look at that and analyze what minerals are in that particular substance. And sometimes they use gas chromatography, and they use like magnets in the gas to deflect the minerals and then separate them by mass. And then that's all analyzed by computer. You know, not being a physicist, I don't really know. I mean, we used a lot of these types of things in organic chemistry. But they use, again, gas chromatography. It's very accurate. Combining mass spec and gas liquid chromatography to identify these substances. And it's pretty much spot on and frequently used in court cases for evidence. And so that's kind of how they do the hair analysis. Now, what type of research is on hair analysis? That's pretty interesting. So that's where we now look at what studies are look at the hair, and is it very valuable? Well, it's interesting. Here's an interesting study from Dr. Gordas from the University of Michigan. Now, he tested the head hair of naval midshipmen in Annapolis, and cadets from West Point. Now, when they first came in, like now we're seeing a lot of freshmen coming in. Now it's August 1st now, today. And now, you know, you'll see a lot of college students going up to college and things like that. Freshman orientation. But when he checked the freshmen and their hair, he found that they had very widely different levels of trace minerals in their hair, and that reflected variation in their where they lived and what they ate and things like that. But as they spent time at the academy, same environment, similar food and things like that, similar stresses. Of course, there's going to be variations individually, but he found that the hair mineral patterns became more and more alike, suggesting that, you know, nutritional intake and your environment, and not just genetics, are the primary factors that determine the amount of nutrients in the hair. So that's an exciting thing. Now, King Tut actually had a hair analysis, too. When we look at forensics, they looked at King Tut's hair, and the researchers found him to have very high levels of arsenic. And, you know, he died, I think, of malaria, according to what I remember. But they probably used arsenic as a medicine in Egyptian times to treat malaria. They often used a lot of the metals. So there's some information on that. So now, what types of things can you tell with the analysis when you look at a hair analysis? Well, I look at metabolic types, whether you're a fast or slow oxidator. I look at stress and your magnesium levels. I look at copper toxicity and the balance of estrogen and testosterone in the body. I look at the adrenal gland and thyroid gland ratios, and then I look at your toxic metals. And from there, I can then determine what types of nutritions. Usually we see in a fast oxidizer very low levels of calcium and magnesium and very high levels of sodium and potassium. The sodium and potassium in the hair analysis is not very similar to the blood sodium and potassium at all. There's no correlation. So that's a mineral where there's not a lot of correlation with the blood levels. But the sodium and potassium in the hair have a lot to do with the mineral corticoids. That's the sodium, which is aldosterone. That's a hormone put out by your adrenals. And the potassium is the glucocorticoids. So also it looks at your phosphorus, too. And then having low calcium and magnesium in the body has to do with when calcium is very high, it actually shuts down the calcium channels of the cell membranes, which allow you to absorb things and, like, bring hormones in your body. So very high calcium on the hair analysis means that you actually have a slow oxidation. A very low calcium on the hair analysis shows that you have a high oxidation. So they're kind of inversely proportional. And so that's the metabolic type. So you can see, now what's great about this is you can tell if a patient has thyroid problems, even if their thyroid hormones are coming back normal from their conventional doctor. Because remember that the blood levels of thyroid hormones don't necessarily tell you what's going on inside your cell. It just shows that your thyroid is making enough hormone, but it's not saying, is the hormone, is the T3 getting, which is the activated part of the thyroid, is it getting inside the cell? Is it getting through the cell membrane and then inside the cell to trigger the metabolic symptom? Now, Broda Barnes and, of course, Dr. Dennis Wilson have looked at the effect of low body temperature on the thyroid. But the mechanism of action of why the thyroid T3 can't get through the cell membrane also has been elucidated, and that has a lot to do with these calcium and potassium channels that are not working well. And in fact, the higher the level of the hair calcium, the lower the effective level of the thyroid gland. We know that hyperthyroidism, too, can cause tetany, or muscle contractions due to low calcium in the body. And that higher calcium means you get the opposite. You get flaccidity. And then potassium, there's some research that low potassium is associated with reduced sensitivity at the cellular mitochondrial level to the thyroid hormone. And, of course, the calcium-potassium channels aren't working. But anyway, I can't go into that much because we're kind of running short in time. But basically, you can tell what your metabolic type is, fast or slow. You can also look at your magnesium status. Then another important thing is your copper status. Now, you know, some researchers feel that copper is kind of like the thing that's going to do civilization in. And I think that's kind of an interesting way of thinking about it. But another analogy is lead was to the Romans as copper is to modern-day people. And, you know, if you know something about history, you know that the Romans drank lots of things out of lead goblets, and that may have led to accelerated dementia and other types of things, and may have caused an issue with their society. I mean, it's just a theory, but fascinating that we're seeing copper do the same things when we made all our pipes out of copper, and now those homes are getting old. Copper's been related to things like fatigue, exhaustion, allergies, foggy mind, mood swings, sensitive moods, loss of control, paranoia, racing heart reactions to vitamins and minerals, problems with concentration and memory, spaciness, panic attacks, candida, aching muscles, hypoglycemia, obsessive thoughts, affects the thyroid. So when copper is very high, that can cause a very interesting problem with the body. Again, it also throws the zinc off, and zinc is very important for your immune system. Zinc has been shown to raise testosterone in the research if a guy is low in testosterone. So if the copper is very high and the zinc's very low, that can lead to an imbalance in the hormones and lead to prostate problems and all kinds of things like that. So all that we look at with the hair. Now, let's talk a little bit about the toxic metals. We'll talk a little bit about some of the research on toxic metals that's been in the peer-reviewed scientific medical literature. Here's one from the journal Biological Trace Element Research in 2011. It's called Lithium and Other Elements in Scalp Hair of Residents of Tokyo as an Investigational Predictor of Suicide Risk. And they found, these scientists, they said high suicide rates in Japan are associated with low levels of lithium, and particularly in the hair, in both men and women. So they looked at this and they found that when cobalt and lithium levels are low in the hair, it's associated with a problem with more of a risk of suicide. So that was really interesting, I thought. Dr. Chopper, J. Chopper, is the researcher on that particular one. Here's one: strong positive correlation for mercury, cadmium, lead, antimony, and bismuth in people from Sweden that lived near and worked with occupation exposure to metals. So they found that there was a strong correlation between the hair and the nails, and that really was associated with a post-mortem look at what toxic metals were deposited in their tissues as well. So another correlation showing that the metals in the hair measured what was being deposited in their organs, like their liver and heart. Here's another one, investigation of arsenic exposure from a soil at Superfund site. Environmental Research, 1995, February, Dr. Hewitt, lead researcher, found that, these 40 employees that were actively working with this pesticide manufacturing facility had urine and hair and fingernails collected, and they found that hair and fingernail were significantly correlated with their exposure, but the urine did not. So this is a thing that kind of knocks the urine analysis for looking at arsenic levels, and indeed supports the use of hair and nails. Now, why would that be? Why would the urine not be showing the high levels of arsenic that these folks... Well, maybe the arsenic was being sequestered and held in their bodies for some reason. And again, you know, the hair, looking at the cellular levels, remember, the body doesn't like things floating around in the system. It doesn't really want the arsenic to be floating around in your bloodstream. It's going to want to take care of that, and if the body can't take care of it in its wisdom, what does it do? It puts it into storage, you know? So it becomes like people's closets, junk closets or garages full of junk. And, you know, I think that we need to take that into consideration. Now, this was a sad story. This was actually published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1984. So by Dr. Peters, and this was a sad story of a rural Wisconsin family who experienced recurring neurologic and medical illness over 3 years, which was worse during the winter months. They couldn't figure it out. The MDs on the case couldn't figure it out. So they went to a specialist in environmental medicine, and they found out that through, again, looking at the hair analysis of those patients, they found out that their arsenic concentration was very, very high. And then it found out in the history that for 4 years, their home had been heated with marine plywood and wood that was used in the building of a deck around their house. And they found, then they went in and they looked at the ashes in their wood-burning stove and found that it contained 1,000 parts per million of arsenic. That's way, way high. And it also contained copper, chromium, and arsenic. Well, that's the pressure-treated lumber stuff. So in this case, they used the hair analysis and nail analysis to smash the case and figure out that these people were poisoned with arsenic. It doesn't say what happened to them. I got to reread the paper and find out whether they did well or not, because then the key is, how do you get the arsenic out? Here's one, that cadmium. Again, these people that worked in China in factories had high levels of cadmium in their hair, and it did correlate on autopsy with the cadmium that was deposited in their kidneys and liver, you know. Here's a big study. This is one of my favorite ones. 51,000 people were studied in this sample. I mean, it's the journal Metabolism, 1997. And they looked at the chromium levels. They looked at the chromium levels in their hair, their sweat, and their serum. And they found that the hair chromium was very, very accurate, and that most of the people with low chromium in the hair went on to get type 2 diabetes and also disordered lipid metabolism, elevated cholesterol, LDLs, abnormal glucose metabolism, and went on to get atherosclerosis. So here's a great way to just screen for chromium. You can do it in young kids. If the chromium is start being low, you know that if it stays low, they're going to end up maybe getting heart disease and diabetes a little later. We have such a epidemic of diabetics now. So let's get people started on some chromium and chromium-rich foods. There's so many more. Here's one that is kind of scary, where they looked at 237 school kids in a lead-polluted area in northern Italy, and they looked at blood, hair, and teeth, and they found that the hair was the best way to determine the lead levels. This is why I wish that the public health departments of all the states would use hair analysis more. Here's one, biological trace element 2011. Levels of trace elements, copper, zinc, magnesium, and selenium, and toxic elements, lead and mercury, in the hair and nails of kids with autism. And they found that kids with autism had higher levels of copper, lead, and mercury, and very low levels of magnesium and selenium compared to normal subjects. So again, hair and nails being a great way to monitor these types of things. Now, when we look at some more modern studies, like here's one which was done very recently, elevated titanium levels in Iraqi children with neurodevelopmental disorders echo findings in their parents. So this was like the GIs came back. They were high in titanium, which is used in, I guess, I don't know what, it's used in war. And they checked the hair samples of their kids, and they had somehow passed it. So I don't know what that's all about, but that's very interesting. There's another one here where this is the Scandinavian Journal of Clinical Lab Investigation 2014, analysis of zinc, copper, and iron in the hair of Chinese children with recurrent respiratory tract infections. So these kids had lots of respiratory tract infections, so the researchers decided to do a hair analysis on them, and they found that they had significantly lower levels of zinc. Particularly, zinc was the worst one, and they felt, the researchers, that the low levels of zinc was contributing to the susceptibility of their upper respiratory infections in the Chinese children. So we see that there's many, many examples of these types of things. The most important one is the aberrant behavior, I think, in the low lithium, I think, is very interesting. Because they've looked at this in even prisons in California and thinking about giving some lithium to these patients. And this is lithium not as the drug, but as the nutrient. Well, I hope I have gotten you to really listen and learn about hair analysis. If you're interested in getting a hair analysis, contact myself or Dr. Kamai. We could point you in the right direction. Thanks for being such an attentive audience, and stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye.